Peter B. Collins, News and Comment. It's Wednesday, June 17th, 2015. Neil Young is pissed at Donald Trump, who apparently doesn't know the lyrics to this song. Bizarre staged event at Trump Towers in New York City yesterday, the Donald and his hair threw a proverbial hat into the ring for the presidential campaign next year. Trump threatened to do this in 2012. He kind of put one toe in back in 2008. But you know he's serious because he dropped his television show, The Apprentice, or whatever they're calling it now, in order to clear the decks to run for president. And you just heard the Neil Young song that he used as the theme as he and Ivanka rode down an escalator to a podium where he bloviated for more than 30 minutes. And the ignorance of the lyrics of Rockin' in the Free World is just one glaring example of how this man's huge ego does not, unfortunately, cover up his idiocy. Now, he is oblivious to it. And yesterday, I listened for a few minutes to Sean Hannity's radio show, and caller after caller was saying, well, we need a successful businessman, you know, run America like a business. Well, Donald Trump is successful in projecting the image of a successful businessman. His companies have been through bankruptcy 5 times. He was virtually broke 20 years ago. And he claims yesterday he waved a document around a current net worth of over $8 billion. I don't actually believe that. And if you want some evidence, go to Atlantic City, New Jersey, where Trump led the charge when casino gambling was legalized, built a huge complex there, and it is all shut down today. And I think it's amazing that the media allows him, and of course NBC gave him that primetime television show where he got to say, you're fired. But aren't there any honest reporters out there who are willing to expose this man for the fraud that he is? And, I mean, Herman Cain was the comic relief in the 2012 campaign. Remember Mr. 999? But he was... He was actually kind of sincere about this. And when you hear Donald Trump say just flatly he's going to build a wall across the southern border, that he's got a secret plan to bring ISIS down, I think this guy has zero credibility. He gives narcissism a bad name. He gives plutocrats a bad reputation. And so last night on The Daily Show, it was kind of juvenile, actually, but Jon Stewart had two of his male reporters start to report about Trump's entry into the race, and they broke down into involuntary orgasmic activity. And then it affected Stewart. And I do agree with John that, what, he's got 6 weeks running before he exits The Daily Show. And this is a big gift to a satirist of a political bent like Jon Stewart. Now to more serious issues. Israel's divide and conquer strategy applied to the Palestinians is in full view once again as the so-called unity government that is less than, well, it's about a year old. This was a new effort by Fatah, which runs the West Bank, and that's run by Mahmoud Abbas, and Hamas, which has control of the Gaza Strip, to form a unity government. And the Abbas people did this very strategically and tried to get the Israelis to accept it. But after the failure of the Kerry-brokered peace talks, where Israel got concessions on virtually everything from the Palestinians, nonetheless, Israel walked away and then announced that this unity government is a threat to its very existence. That led to the 51-day brutal assault on Gaza last summer. And now we learn that Hamas was engaged in some indirect communications with the Israelis about trying to solidify the ceasefire from last summer. And I don't know that this violated any protocols or any agreements between Fatah and Hamas. But Abbas said, well, we're going to dissolve this because Hamas didn't let it work in Gaza, whatever that means. But I see this as just another extension of the successful Israeli efforts to get Palestinians to fight against Palestinians. And I'm very sorry to see this happen. And we'll have to see how it plays out. And if Hamas is resisting this, they're saying we weren't consulted and we don't agree to this. But I'm not sure that they have much leverage over Mahmoud Abbas. And we'll have to see how that plays out. But this gives me an opportunity to share with you some information I got last week that I've been holding on to. The RAND Corporation, which is a think tank that often does future scenario planning for our government. And, you know, I don't buy into everything that comes out of the RAND Corporation. After all, Daniel Ellsberg worked for them when he famously leaked the Pentagon Papers. But that said, this new RAND Corporation study looked at five possible scenarios in resolving the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And they then applied economic projections. Israel's economy, under a two-state solution, would gain $123 billion over the next decade, about $12 billion a year, and per capita income would jump 5%, by about $2,200 per person. And in independent Palestine, the economy would grow by $50 billion, or about $5 billion a year, with per capita income rising about $1,000, or 36%. Contrast that with the negative scenarios. A return to violence is projected to cause a 46% drop in per capita gross domestic product in the West Bank and Gaza by 2024, while Israel's would decline by 10%. Israel's military spending would rise 3% and tourism would drop by 25%. Well, these are interesting projections. But it sorely points out that the continuation of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict is not in the self-interest of either population. And yet it will persist for the foreseeable future. Well, we've got another one of these cases where the FBI has busted a guy claiming he wanted to join the Islamic State, claiming he had terrorist intentions. And once again, I'm skeptical of this account from our government. On Saturday morning, 20-year-old Munther Omar Saleh, a student at New York City College, was arrested after he and another man got out of their car and ran toward a surveillance vehicle that had been tracking their movements. Now, this young man has been in contact with the FBI because he allowed them to look at his computer. And this gives me the suspicion that he has been under surveillance and perhaps subject to a paid FBI informant, as we have seen in hundreds of these so-called domestic terrorism busts. And, of course, we hear only from the government. They claim that their surveillance showed that he had been looking up information on how to make a pressure cooker bomb, that he had expressed support for the Islamic State over Al-Qaeda, saying, I fear that AQ could be getting too moderate. Now, there is no indication that he possessed a pressure cooker bomb or was about to detonate it. He and his friend ran toward a surveillance vehicle, and at that point, they busted him. And so the evidence that's presented so far is a series of thought crimes. He was thinking about a pressure cooker bomb. He read a lot about the Boston Marathon Massacre. So have I. And they said that his computer contained Islamic State propaganda. Is that a crime? Not to my knowledge. Now, against this backdrop of this latest highly publicized FBI investigation of a so-called domestic terrorist, the New York Times has published another story summarizing the alleged expanding influence of the Islamic State with a colorful map. And I'm going to link to this interactive page on the New York Times website so you can see it for yourself. And the article says where ISIS, or the Islamic State, Daesh, ISIL, all those names, where ISIS has directed and inspired attacks around the world. Now, there is a huge distinction between directing attacks and inspiring them. And I have a big problem with so many of these cases because this map, for example, shows the events in Canada earlier this year with little red circles saying that these were attacks inspired by ISIS. And one was a guy in Quebec, the other was the guy who tried to shoot up the parliament in Ontario. Now, in each case, if you look carefully, these men were not directed by anyone in the Middle East. They were not in contact or in direct contact. They may have read different information online. They may have been inspired or in awe of certain jihadi leaders. But for the New York Times to use this graphic and put a little red circle saying that those attacks in Canada were inspired by the Islamic State, that is hugely misleading. Now, this also, for example, shows that the core countries of the Islamic State are Syria and Iraq. That is correct. But then they show Saudi Arabia, Yemen, Afghanistan, Pakistan, Egypt, and Libya as countries where ISIS has declared provinces. Now, the Islamic State can make all kinds of declarations, and local people can pledge allegiance. That doesn't mean that there is direct command and control from al-Baghdadi in Raqqa to someone in Algeria or in Libya. And so for the Times to use these exaggerations to publish as fact the assertions that, for example, the Canadian attacks were inspired by ISIS, this helps stoke the hysteria and the war fever in this country. And I hope you'll take a close look at this because the Times shows worldwide and then they just list in order descriptions of the major attacks and arrests. And they start with the one I just told you about, the arrest in Queens of the guy who was thinking about a pressure cooker bomb. And I am deeply concerned that our media is enabling the incredible exaggeration of threats, particularly against Americans in the United States. And this informs a vote that I consider to be relatively meaningless, a kind of feel-good, non-binding vote in the Senate yesterday. And I talked about this last week. Dianne Feinstein from California, John McCain from Arizona, co-sponsored an amendment to the Pentagon budget bill to ban torture. Now, torture is already illegal, so this is gratuitous. But Feinstein and McCain say, well, Obama issued an executive order banning torture, and we want to give that the force of law. Well, that's a nice sentiment, only I've read the draft of this bill, and there is no enforcement mechanism whatsoever. It doesn't hold anyone accountable. It doesn't say that the next John Yoo, the next Don Rumsfeld, the next Dick Cheney would be held responsible. Or that a high-ranking CIA official by, like, Alfreda Frances Bukowski, who we pretend her name is secret and her identity is secret and her role is secret, But she was on the front lines of waterboarding and torture regimes. There's nothing in this bill that would hold Bukowski accountable for future torture. Now, nevertheless, this is, as I say, a toothless resolution of the sentiment of the Senate, in my humble opinion. 21 Republicans voted against it. People like Mitch McConnell, arguing that, we may need this power in the future. We don't want to ban torture. Marco Rubio was not present, but he says, I would have voted no on this. I don't support telegraphing to the enemy what interrogation techniques we will or won't use and denying future commanders-in-chief and intelligence officials important tools for protecting the American people and the U.S. homeland. Yeah. And Jeb, we're not allowed to use his last name, Jeb was asked by Sean Hannity about enhanced interrogation methods, and he said, well, I think it was appropriate at the time. I don't think we need it now. And Laura Pitter has it right. She's a senior security, a National Security Council at Human Rights Watch. She said that the techniques used by the CIA were already clearly prohibited under U.S. law when they were practiced, and it's possible a future administration could once again find a way around the rules. Nevertheless, she's not opposed to this, and neither am I. But that's not the same as saying that torture works. And that's what 21 members of the Senate, including McConnell and John Cornyn, and the hard right candidates who want to be president, they believe Zero Dark 30. They don't believe the truth. That torture doesn't work. Torture didn't lead to bin Laden. But that's the fiction that they wish to embrace because it is so effective with the Republican base voters. Just like Benghazi. All you got to do is say Benghazi, Benghazi, Benghazi. Well, yesterday, Sidney Blumenthal was deposed by Trey Gowdy's Select Committee on Benghazi. And some interesting things surfaced. As you know, Blumenthal was peppering Hillary Clinton as she was Secretary of State with memos about Libya. And it's because Sidney Blumenthal was looking for highly compensated business opportunities in Libya. He was partnering with a guy named Tyler Drumheller, a fairly infamous CIA retiree. Now, to Drumheller's credit, he was one of the people who tried to dial back Colin Powell's speech about the mobile weapons labs and the phony threat of WMD in Iraq. So I'm not saying that Tyler Drumheller is always wrong. But it turns out that Drumheller was the main author of the memos that Blumenthal was sending to Hillary Clinton. And these are the memos that State Department staff were saying, what? Huh? This doesn't sound right. Well, at the same time, according to a leak from a Romanian hacker, Tyler Drumheller was offering to advise the new government in Libya on relationships with American business leaders and the U.S. government, presumably for a fat fee. So we have profiteers who were using their access to the Secretary of State. And I'll remind you that Sidney Blumenthal was pulling down $10,000 a month from the Clinton Foundation at the time he was feeding these Drumheller memos to Hillary Clinton. And so this Benghazi thing, as you know, I don't think is that significant. But it appears that because of her attempt to control her emails, because some of these Blumenthal emails were not included in those that were delivered by the State Department to the committee, there are more problems here with Hillary's story and with her liability for the entire problem with Libya, not simply the events in Benghazi one night in September 2012. Also on Capitol Hill yesterday, Democrats and Republicans hammered the Inspector General and the Director of the Office of Personnel Management because they were warned over a year ago that their computer systems were vulnerable. And Jason Chaffetz, who's an opportunist, one of those aggressive Republicans who chairs the Oversight and Government Reform Committee. I think he got it right. He said, you failed utterly and totally. They recommended that it was so bad that you shut it down, and you didn't. And he directed that to Catherine Archuleta, who is the director of the Office of Personnel Management. And he asked her to resign. He asked her to apologize, and she did neither. Every day I like to acknowledge the people who support my work at the Peter B. Collins Podcast with your contributions, your subscriptions. People like Wendy Gebauer, Gunnar Gunderson, who has more than one subscription, Bob Donjakour, and Brian Massey. They're all supporters, and I'd like you to join them. Come on over to peterbcollins.com. Under my picture, it says sign up. You click on that link. The next page, you can choose from $5 or $10, $20 a month, or our best deal, the $50 annual subscription. I just shipped out a couple of bonus gifts the other day. If you're a new annual subscriber anywhere in the world, I will send you an ebook edition of Pepe Escobar's latest called Empire of Chaos. Well, you may have heard that across the bay from me in Berkeley, a group of students were celebrating a birthday, and many of them went out on a balcony, more than the balcony could support, and it collapsed. Six were killed, seven were injured. Five of those who died are Irish students who were visiting the United States for the summer on a J-1 visa. And I don't ordinarily cover stories like this. It's tragic, but I consider it pretty local. And it doesn't have any, you know, major impact on policy and those sorts of things. But the New York Times coverage of it, and I've just learned about this from the Times' own public editor, is telling us that the Times really blew it. Because they were one of the first to break the story. But in their second story about this tragic event, they included this language, that the J-1 visa program is not just a source of aspiration, but a source of embarrassment for Ireland, marked by a series of high-profile episodes involving drunken partying and the wrecking of apartments in places like San Francisco and Santa Barbara. Now, as an American of Irish descent, I take a little exception to this, and it does seem insensitive and unnecessary so quickly after these people have died to paint this picture that they're part of a larger group of reckless Irish drinkers and boozers who come to the United States and get involved in tragic incidents like this. And to her credit, the public editor at the Times has called the paper out on this. The Bay Area is excited that the Golden State Warriors were victorious in Cleveland last night and nailed the NBA championship. First time in 40 years that Oakland gets the trophy. And it may be the last because the people, the rich guys who own the Warriors, are trying to build a new arena across the bay in San Francisco. And the history of the Warriors were, they were originally a San Francisco team, but Franklin Muley, who owned it, moved them to Oakland, but didn't call them the Oakland Warriors. They've always been called the Golden State Warriors. And Oakland really deserves the honor of this victory. Not Golden State, that's not even a place. So there's a lot of controversy over the siting of this new arena in San Francisco. I won't draw you into it, but it has slowed down the planned construction. And maybe if the team is successful in the next year or two, Oakland will get another trophy. But in President Obama's 2016 budget proposal, and I've just learned about this recently, he has called for ending tax-free government bonds for the construction of sports facilities, which have cost taxpayers $4 billion over the last 30 years. And I salute this. There is no reason that public money should be used to subsidize the facilities used for these massively profitable pro sports franchises. And I'm glad to see that President Obama is acting on that particular issue. A labor commission here in California has set a new precedent that could undermine the disruptive business plan of the disruptor Uber. Uber is this, it's really a taxi service, but they call it ride sharing. And Uber takes the position that all of its drivers are not employees. They are independent contractors. So they don't have to submit withheld taxes for them. They don't have to give them benefits. They're treated like independent contractors in every respect. But the Labor Commission has said, wait a minute. Uber drivers, at least in the case that was brought to their attention, are employees, not independent contractors, because everything they do is controlled by Uber and the app that Uber gives to its drivers. Now, Uber has appealed this. That's why we have learned about it. And this could stall their plans for an IPO, an initial public offering. And I know a lot of people who are not happy about Uber and Lyft. And they're not all cab drivers. And I've never used an Uber or a Lyft. And I respect that some people, you know, can use the smartphone app and make extra money on the side. But it comes at the expense of the existing taxi cab concessions and drivers who've paid often hundreds of thousands of dollars to buy a medallion that legitimizes their taxi service. And here in San Francisco, which is kind of ground zero for a lot of these disruptive business models, the government leaders have just been too accepting, partly because people like Uber, they pass around a lot of campaign contributions. They grease the wheels. But if we're honest and objective about it, Uber does operate in a way that its drivers are employees, just like a yellow cab company. And I don't think they should be permitted to pretend otherwise. Good news from New Hampshire, where Bernie Sanders has moved into a solid second place to Hillary Clinton in the latest poll. Democratic voters rank Clinton as first at 44%. But a strong second showing by Sanders from neighboring Vermont at 32%, just 12 points behind Hillary. And the next candidate down is Joe Biden, who's not even an announced candidate, showing only 8%, and Martin O'Malley below that. So I take that as a very interesting indication that people are willing to ignore the media's portrayal of Sanders as a hapless, hopeless, fringe candidate. And the people in New Hampshire are taking him seriously. I like that a lot. And finally today, I was struck by this item that I found on the homepage of the New York Times website, all about what I do. It's called podcasting. And Farhad Manju, who writes the State of the Art column at the Times, notes the breakout success of the NPR spinoff Serial as a podcast last year. And he says, while the hype from that has cooled, podcasting is still chugging along. 17% of Americans in February listened to at least one podcast in the previous month. And that's a slow increase from 14% a couple of years ago. I'll link to this story so you can read it, because it shows that there's a lot of activity in the podcast space and that some people are able to generate revenue from advertising. And candidly, that's what I hope to do long term. I have not been able to find a model and a sponsor that has worked to properly, you know, benefit me with a revenue stream without alienating you with offensive commercials or an inappropriate advertiser or message. So I'm pleased to see that Americans understand that you can get audio programs from independent purveyors like Peter B. Collins on your smartphone. And if you, for example, are still listening on a desktop computer, there's nothing wrong with that. You can listen any way you like. But I want to make sure you know about Stitcher. Stitcher, S-T-I-T-C-H-E-R, Stitcher.com. It's a free app that you put on your smartphone, and you can access the Peter B. Collins podcast every day. via Stitcher on your smartphone. The app is free. There's no charge to use the service at Stitcher. And I love it because I use it quite a bit to share my podcasts with people. And it's just another way that you can connect up with the Peter B. Collins podcast. Thanks for joining me today. I appreciate you listening. And you are free to share this podcast via Stitcher or anywhere else with absolutely everyone. I'm Peter B. Collins.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling until then.